Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is the day of the month where we talk about money management, and we're pleased to have back here on the program David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and on a regular basis here, he stops by and talks a little bit about economic issues, then goes on to talk about how those things connect with people's investment strategies. There may be something he'd like you to be thinking about, or he'd say it would be a good idea to be thinking about, and then we can go on from that, from his remarks here at the beginning, and to take questions about that or anything else that has to do with money management or investing. I know that if you have a specific question, he will do his best to help you out. And with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here once again.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, approximately 3 weeks ago, investors, well, they were pretty happy with stocks and Wall Street in general. Then an unusual confluence of short-term events resulted in stock market volatility that we really haven't seen in about 4 years. These events, of course, triggered substantially lower stock prices around the globe. The short-term damage began in China on Monday, February 26th, with a nearly 9% fall in stock prices in Shanghai, certainly one of the most volatile markets in a global sense. You might recall that Chinese stocks have just jumped dramatically. It's sort of like climbing a mountain, if you will, and certainly were set for some type of setback. Simultaneously, Alan Greenspan, our former Fed chairman, that very Monday via satellite, told a global audience that, quote, a U.S. recession was possible. Now, Mr. Greenspan, however, did not say a recession was likely. Indeed, his carefully chosen remarks actually suggested the contrary, that the U.S. economy would continue to expand, although at a slower pace. Also, investors were simultaneously realizing that fourth quarter 2006 U.S. GDP was overstated by more than 1%, and suddenly we had the perfect storm. On Tuesday, February 27th, the U.S. stock market and most asset classes dropped some 3 to 4% in value. For example, the Dow Jones dropped some 416 points, or 3.3% in value, and the tech-dominated NASDAQ dropped almost 4%. Well, during the next 2 weeks, stocks sort of recovered from some of these losses, and suddenly the financial markets were once again bombarded with news that mortgage foreclosures have reached new highs in the United States, especially in subprime mortgages. Subprime mortgages were defaulting at a rate believed to be as high as almost 9%. Now, subprime mortgages are mortgages granted to very, well, let's call them iffy borrowers, at about market interest, far above market interest rates. In fact, 20% of the $3 trillion annual mortgage market consists of these subprime mortgages. And the second largest player in this marketplace is a firm called New Century, which is now on the verge of bankruptcy due to poor underwriting standards, overly generous salaries and benefits to senior members of the firm, and apparent accounting irregularities as well. Now, let's figure out how this actually happens. Let's assume that John Doe wants to buy a house but really can't qualify for a conventional 80% loan, which probably would be available today at about 6 to 6.5% interest, amortized monthly over 30 years, but he simply doesn't qualify. He doesn't meet the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines for a conventional mortgage. But the mortgage broker says to John, hey, that's okay. You just don't meet the qualifications for a conventional loan, but I can arrange a loan for you. In fact, I can arrange a 95% loan to value or perhaps a 100% loan to value, but the interest rate is going to be a bit steeper, maybe 9%, maybe 10%, maybe even 11%. But here's the good news. For the first 2 years of the loan, you pay interest only. You don't even have to pay on the darn principal. So John, of course, jumps at this so-called mortgage opportunity. Let's remember, this is a mortgage opportunity. After all, housing prices are still escalating. This is 2004, 2005, when the housing market is just as hot as a pistol and housing prices are going up. And frankly, this is when a lot of these loans were made. New Century provides the money to John Doe to close the loan. And, of course, John Doe signs the requisite documents, which are really a note and a mortgage document saying, oh, yes, I will pay all of this money back very, very timely. Well, one question, where in the world did New Century get the money in the first place to loan to John Doe? Enter Wall Street. We've always got Wall Street out there and major investment banking firms and money center banks. They provided the money short term to New Century, who then turns around and loans it to these borrowers in order to close the loans. Next, New Century, with the help of investment bankers, bundles hundreds of these mortgages together and creates what's called a mortgage-backed security, which was then sold, of course, to the general public. So we could buy these mortgage-backed securities, mutual funds buy these mortgage-backed securities, corporations and even foreign investors buy these mortgage-backed securities. Now, originally, everybody is very, very happy. John Doe obtains his loan, even though the interest rate is very high. But he doesn't have to worry for a couple of years because he's not paying back principal. And the theory is that whatever I'm paying, that's less than the inflation increase in the value of the house. Second, the mortgage broker who puts the deal together sort of matches New Century with John Doe. Well, he or she is happy because they receive a commission on closing the mortgage loan. New Century, well, they're very happy as they earn substantial fees when these loans are reissued as subprime mortgage-backed securities back in the secondary market. And, of course, the investment bankers, they're always happy. When they put a deal together and bring money and people together, you can bet the investment bankers are going to earn fees for putting the whole deal together. And the final purchasers of these mortgage-backed securities, well, they're initially happy at the very high interest rates they're being paid on this mortgage pool. And after all, their mortgage pool is backed by this bundle of mortgages that are out there. But of course, those mortgages are lenders and loans to subprime borrowers. Well, the story, of course, as we know, doesn't have a particularly happy ending. You see that John Doe and literally thousands of other John Does are now defaulting on these subprime loans. And the end purchasers, the mutual funds and the public, are now scurrying like little rats to sell or protect their investments. The situation will probably get a bit worse before it gets better because all of these foreclosures, that's what's really happening now, all of these properties are being foreclosed, means that there is a flood of additional housing stock for sale on top of the very large inventory of homes already for sale in most major markets of the United States. It's no secret that the housing market, well, it's just sort of stopped in its tracks. Developers have new construction homes for sale. People are trying to sell their homes, and now we're having this proliferation of foreclosed homes also hitting the market. As a result, new housing starts are going to decrease. Construction workers are likely to be laid off. Fewer purchasers mean, I guess, less carpet being bought, less appliances, less furniture, and you can see the potential ripple effect on our economy. It's estimated, in fact, that this mortgage debacle could shave as much as 1% off our annual gross domestic product, which could potentially, and I just say potentially, trigger a recession. Maybe that's what Alan Greenspan had in mind just 3 weeks ago. And those confluence of events is the likely reason that Wall Street is so nervous and stocks are so volatile. But here's the good news. In spite of all of that bad news, our couch potato portfolio has been pretty darn resilient over the first 2.5 months of this year. Now, through last night's close, the portfolio return for the year, including dividends, is approximately 0.1%. Well, you can't get very excited about being up 0.1%, but not too bad when a whole lot of folks out there are down 5, 6, 7, 8, and 10% for the year because they bought and they sold and they weren't properly diversified in asset classes. Now, I want you to recall that last month I recommended a small tactical reallocation in our couch potato portfolio. Last month, we reduced our exposure to the emerging markets from an approximate 10% position to a 5% position, and we took that 5% and increased our exposure to the total international index. And secondly, we reduced our REIT exposure, those real estate investment trusts, from essentially 10% down to 7%. So we took a 3% reduction, and we took those monies and reinvested them in small cap value and large value. And I believe that Jack Brighton just today was updating that couch potato portfolio on the WILL website, showing basically it's up close to 0.1%. And if we look at our benchmark, our bogey, we could say that's the S&P 500 index. How has that fared since January 1? Well, that's down 1.5% for the year. So we're certainly doing a significantly better than the S&P 500. So in spite of a volatile market, the good news is that a well-diversified portfolio has not been tremendously impacted by the stock market volatility. And as I continue to harp each period, it's not how much money you earn in the good times. Anybody can throw darts at the stock market in the good times and earn money. It's those invariably poor periods when stocks go down, it's how little money you lose in those periods when it doesn't matter what you're in. Those classes of stocks are going to drop. And that's when diversification makes so much difference. It ameliorates the impact of a drop in the stock market. So your goal is to lose as little as possible in those periods of time when stock markets drop and look for buying opportunities after precipitous drops in the stock market. Because remember, we're in the share accumulation business. We're not in the price accumulation business. We're in the share accumulation business. And he or she who has the most shares of these positions at the end of the day really are the winners. Well, there you have it, David, a little bit about the stock market. And of course, I'd be delighted to answer questions from our audience and try at least to answer those questions on the minds of those folks listening this morning.
All right. Very good. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance at U of I in the College of Business. And once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. And questions are certainly welcome. These are the numbers. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Let me ask you a mortgage-related question.
Sure.
As you say, people, I'm sure, have been hearing the stories about the problems associated with subprime mortgages. You can understand that for some people that might have at one point been an attractive idea because the interest rates initially to get in were attractive. What do you think generally about the concept, though, of a more conventional adjustable rate mortgage? Or would you still say, you know, I would feel more comfortable locking in a rate and knowing that that's what it is on the first day and that's what it's always going to be?
Well, you know my conservative philosophy, David. You've just taken the words out of my mouth. And interestingly enough, rates are extraordinarily competitive right now. Mm. That you can lock in 15-year fully amortizing rates at about 6%. And if you really shop, I've seen 5.9% out there. And for a 30-year conventional, it's in the 6 to 6.5% range, maybe call it 6.25%. Historically, these are excellent, excellent rates. Now, some people may have refinanced in adjustable rate mortgages and may find themselves that they were able to refinance into an ARM, maybe a 3-1 ARM, which locks in a rate for 3 years and then it can move 2% up or down each year thereafter with a maximum cap of 6% in any direction. Maybe they started out with a low rate of perhaps even 3.5%, 3.75%. Those are out there and those were locked in for 3 years. Keep in mind then it would move up 2%, so you'd be at 5.75%, which would still be below the market. And if someone put a gun to my head, do I see precipitous increases in interest rates in the economy? I really don't. I really don't. If you look at the 10-year Treasury today, the 10-year Treasury, if you went out and bought one, said, okay, I think I'll buy a 10-year Treasury and just earn some interest, put it away in my lockbox and collect my interest rates on it, that's about 4.5% to 4.6%. Not tremendously interesting. And if you look at the mortgage market usually plays off the 10-year Treasury. You add somewhere between 150 and 175 basis points, or 1.5% to 1.75% to that 10-year Treasury rate, and that gives you a pretty good idea of the mortgage market. So we're looking somewhere around that 6.25%, and again, historically, that's been a pretty decent rate. And again, you're not being rewarded for tying your money up for 10 years when you can go out in national money market accounts today or in the alternative, very, very competitive bank products and CD products, for example, and you can still earn short-term in that 5% range. So it's very, very tough to make an argument to tie your money up for 10 years at 4.5%. But over long periods of time, we're in historically low interest rate period. So it's a matter of time. I'm not saying when. Is it next year, the year after? Who knows? But mortgage rates in that 6 to 6.25%, fully amortizing, a pretty decent deal.
Yeah. I'm sure that when people sit down and they're trying to make the decision about they're borrowing money, they're going to buy a house, and they're particularly looking at this big decision, well, do I do 15 years, do I do 30 years? That for some people, the issue of the monthly payment is going to be critical.
Absolutely.
They could just say, I can make this kind of payment, but past that, I can't go. So that might be one issue. But if people did have the flexibility, they might on the one hand say, well, you know, look at we might as well go with the lower payment. We'll go with 30. I guess the thing that you want to remind people as well, you just have to consider that how much of this is interest, how much of this is principal. And, you know, there's a tremendous difference between what you're paying in 15 years and 30 years. And if you can possibly do 15 years, you probably want to do 15
Well, here's the
years.
Bottom line, David. On a typical 30-year loan, at the end of 10 years, you've paid off 10% of the principal. On a 15-year loan, at the end of 10 years, you've paid off 50% of the principal. So keep in mind what people can do in order to maintain a lower payment. They could take a loan for 30 years, but typically, in almost all residential loans, certainly in Illinois, first mortgage loans, you've got a right to prepay. Mm-hmm. So you could always pay more down on that loan on a monthly basis and amortize it over a shorter period of time mm-hmm. if you find yourself in a position to do so.
And something that also, and you know, I guess I have to be honest, not being a man with much of a head for figures, that I've ever quite understood this, but there is some banks, some lenders will give you the opportunity of paying, instead of paying your payment as one payment once a month,
You pay bi-weekly. Yes.
And you split it. And yes. That by doing that, you actually...
Oh, you cut way
you
down.
You come out ahead.
You cut out ahead. But remember, when you pay bi-weekly, you're making 26 payments. Divided by 2 is 13. So you're actually making 13 annual payments as opposed to 12 annual payments. And you're paying them slightly earlier in the month. Mm-hmm. So as a result, you're paying more principal and you're continuing to save a little bit on interest. So you're right. You're right. For people who can do that, not a bad deal.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk with a caller. We have someone here on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you might comment on Ameren based on the fact that it's recently had its status lowered in terms of creditworthiness, but understanding that it seems to be making a lot of money on all of us. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's more of a political issue than an economic issue, and I really don't have an opinion about individual stocks. What I can say about the Ameren IP controversy, it was interesting. I was sitting down last night with a gentleman from Ameren IP and having a dinner with him, and I asked him that very, very question. And, of course, he felt very, very strongly that, number one, it's very difficult when you essentially tie up rates for 10 years. And remember when those rates were tied up for 10 years, that just before that, the Illinois legislature, in concert with the Commerce Commission, required Illinois Power to reduce their rates by 15%. So it doesn't surprise me that when we have major storms and people complain about infrastructure and power lines, etc., you have to have companies making profit. Now, the difficult part is, are they or are they not making a profit? And that's a whole different question, and that takes a rigorous look at the books and the accounting, and that part I'm not really prepared to talk about. But it is disconcerting if a utility is downgraded. And most utilities, to do business, they typically borrow large sums of money because they borrow that money against future cash flow. The future cash flow is guaranteed by the power payments. So as a result, if their interest rates are increasing because of a downgrade, and that's what happens if you're downgraded to borrow money, it's going to cost more money. That's got to be pushed on to the consumer. So I don't think that's a good thing. That's the bottom line. But as far as the company itself, I really don't have enough knowledge, enough internal information to make a reasonable judgment other than it's not a good thing when utility companies are downgraded. I'll keep in mind that Ameren IP also earns a good deal of money from Clinton, which is a nuclear generating station as well.
All right. Well, other questions. If you have questions about financial planning, money management, your own particular strategies, you're thinking about doing something, making a decision, making a move, we always would say, you know, get as much advice as you can. Think carefully about it. And here would be one opportunity to ask some basic questions. And Dave, I know he would do his best to help you out. 333-9455. That's the Champaign Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And I guess this morning, Dave Zinno, he's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. We do these shows with him here once a month to give people the opportunity to call in and ask questions. And I think we're getting some other callers lined up here. We will go next to someone on our line number one right here. Hello.
Yes, I have two brief questions. One, back to the subprime mortgage crisis, and I'll put that in quotes since you've allayed some of my anxiety. But I do have a lot of mutual funds, and even though it's diversified, I read an article that mutual funds could be adversely affected, at least some of them, because they may have purchased some of these subprime securities.
Let's take that question first, if you'll stay on the line. That is certainly the case if you are in some type of income-generating mutual fund. And what you can do is you typically can go to the prospectus, or you certainly could call the mutual fund, and you can ask for a breakdown of the quality of the mutual fund holdings. In other words, how they are rated by the various rating agencies. Are we in treasuries? Are we in corporates? Are we in mortgage backs? What is the percentage? And very, very quickly, you should be able to glean to what level of coverage, to what level of exposure you might have in any mutual fund. You can just ask them flat out, what percentage of the assets in this mutual fund are held in subprime mortgages?
All right.
That's the question that you want to ask.
All right. Thank you. Second question, briefly, and maybe this is a political question, and maybe you'll shun it, and I could understand, but do you think it's prudent for the former Fed chief, Greenspan, to sort of upstage the current Fed chief and create volatility in the markets when he makes comments that he made, when he made comments that attributed to him about a possibility of a recession?
Well, I think that Mr. Greenspan probably will be a lot more careful next time. It's very interesting how many people still think he's the guru, in spite of the fact that he's not, So I don't think it was intentional, and if the remarks in the entire speech were looked at, he really said, I don't expect a recession, but even mentioning the word out of Alan Greenspan's mouth was enough, along with this confluence of other events, to create some of this volatility. So I think that's the answer, really, to the question. We're not going to hear the word recession, I don't think, out of Mr. Greenspan's mouth again.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Effingham. This would be line number two. Hello.
Yes, on your couch potato portfolio, when you rebalance it, if you rebalance quarterly or yearly, what effect would that have on the holdings of it?
Well, usually I do it the second day of the trading year or the first day of the trading year. So I don't rebalance quarterly, semi-annually, or annually, because very frankly, most of the academic studies that I've looked at suggest that rebalancing that often really has very, very tiny impact on the overall return of the portfolio. And I sometimes think benign neglect is best, and that is that once I'm comfortable with my asset allocation and I'm comfortable with my overall choices within those various asset classes, I'm going to let those ride. But I think clearly, at least once a year, that it's important that we rebalance. So I'm just a annual rebalancer. Does that answer your question?
Then when you put more money into it, you could at the end of the year or at the beginning of the year use that as a rebalancing instead of making sales in it.
Well, that's true too. Now, the other thing is if you're thinking of adding money during the year, and a lot of people are adding money, and of course that's a good idea because then you're dollar cost averaging. And essentially what you would do is you would look at that percentage, and let's say that you had $1,000 a month that you were adding to the couch potato portfolio, essentially 25% of it would be in total international index, for example. 10% would be in the S&P 500. So you would simply add in the percentage of the overall portfolio. But if you were going to simply add once a year, then obviously you could utilize that to help rebalance the portfolio. So either way makes sense.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right, my pleasure.
You. David Sinnoh is our guest. Again, he is a clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. And once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a real quick question here that came up from someone off the air.
Okay.
And goes back to this, to what's going on with the problems with subprime loans. Obviously, as you said, what happens is we have a lot of people defaulting. Now we suddenly have a lot of property on the market. And
yes,
if you're a seller, this is bad. This is not good for you. If for example, you've decided for whatever reason, okay, this is the time for us to sell our house, this is not helpful. The question from the caller was, well, is that actually, though, might that be good for buyers, because that might tend to also, it may depress property values, but it may also depress interest rates.
No question.
Yes? Yes.
No question. It's great for buyers. Now, remember that these foreclosures are taking place in, frankly, larger marketplaces. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about the Champaign Urbanas of the world. We're really talking about much larger marketplaces. We're just a tertiary market, and there's very low foreclosure rates in an area like ourselves. But in the metropolitan areas, no question, if you are a buyer, certainly it makes great sense. And also, if you are going to borrow money, there is more competition out there because the housing market has slowed down. So we've got lots of lenders. We've got lots of capital that needs to be placed into the system. And when you have less demand and lots of supply of capital, what's that going to do to price? It's going to depress price. Mm-hmm. And as a result, that's why interest rates are very competitive right now on fully amortizing loans. So yes, if you're a buyer, you can negotiate. And I even told my class, because we've got a lot of graduating seniors who are going to move back up to the city and are going to want to buy a condominium or a townhouse. And I said, look, you need to work with a realtor who is not embarrassed about putting in a lower offer than is typical for a property that you're looking at. Don't be embarrassed about that. What's the worst? Yeah. The worst is a no. It's rejection. That's okay. So if I was a buyer, I'd want to work with an aggressive realtor who is willing to help me find a deal and then a lowball offer.
Yeah,
sellers don't want to hear that.
You've talked about that before. Well, there may in fact be some realtors who you might say, okay, here's what I want to offer. The realtor says, I'm not going to make that
mm-hmm,
offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you might have to say, well, okay. Then
thank you.
We'll see. I'll go on to somebody else.
Right. Right. I mean, the realtor's going to tell you if it's reasonable or not. I'm not talking about, you know, a 50% offer, but something substantially lower than typically is offered. Because one of the things that you can do with a multiple listing service is the realtor can tell you, all right, of all the properties in this particular geographic area, What do they list for, and what do they actually sell for as a percentage of the listing price? Do they sell at 92% of the listing price? Do they sell typically at 93%? Okay, if the area geographically typically sells at about 93% of the listing price, it's certainly reasonable to go in with an offer at 80 or 85% of the listing price. You see? So that's how you can tell where you can gauge a reasonable offer at.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Charleston. Line four. Hello.
Hello. I have a question for David about I-bonds. Yes. I was wondering, in this climate presently, I know that they are they're ultra-conservative, but where do you see them going, and are they something that would be prudent for a retirement portfolio for a person currently in retirement?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think they are very difficult to glean where they're going to be. I'm, at the moment, much happier with short-term fixed income as opposed to being in a mutual fund with I-bonds.
Yes, well, these were I-bonds for which I have the I get the certificate.
Oh, all right, then you're fine. If you're going to hold those to maturity, I have no problem
with
that.
Yes, and you do have a little bit of a tax break there. You know, you
absolutely
pay your taxes later.
Absolutely.
And
so,
I don't really need the funds right now.
Okay, so I don't have problems in your particular case as long as you're a holder to maturity and you are holding the actual certificates as opposed to buying them inside a fund.
I see. And do you know offhand right now what they're going for during the 6 months? I can find out through a Treasury Direct number that I have.
You know, I don't have that on in front of me. You can go to Treasury Direct, obviously, on your computer, and they can tell you as well. I'm sorry, I just don't have that in front
That's
of me.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Let's continue. We'll talk next with somebody in St. Joe. No, pardon me. Urbana is next. Line one.
Is that my
yes.
turn?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I just heard the woman talk about Ameren, and so I just wanted to give you some information that I have about Ameren's profits jumped to 18%, jumped 18% in 2005, up to $628 million, and that is with electric rates frozen for 9 years, and now there is no cap on the rates. So I just thought I'd offer that information.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
All right. I don't know if there's anything else you want to comment
It'd be interesting to know what the 2006 profits are. And the question then becomes, is $628 million reasonable, unreasonable, if those profits are essentially poured back into infrastructure, et cetera? So because a company makes profit, is that an after-tax profit, a pre-tax profit? So there's a lot of questions. But The interesting fact is, it sounds like they were profitable, all right, with frozen rates.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to next St. Joe. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how to locate Mr. Sinnoh's recommended portfolio on your website?
Yeah, I think that if you just go to Focus 580.
Right. You go to Focus 580, yeah. And then there's a little search, and you can put in Couch Potato Portfolio. And it'll pop right up.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and then we'll go again to another caller here. This is Urbana, and it's line three. Hello.
Hello. As an aside, I Googled up Ameren, and I found in 2005, according to Hoover, an analysis company, that net income growth was 14.3% for the year. So that is very good. I would think most of us would like to get a 14% raise. But that wasn't what I was calling about. I observed that from the president on down, capitalism's mantra is growth. And with economic growth, we have increased pollution and more trash. There must be a better way. I can't think of it. Do you have any observations on that?
It's a problem. There's no question that with growth comes negative externalities, and finally it appears that there's a whole lot of folks who are starting to worry about what this continent and what this world is going to look like in 25 to 75 years with global warming, et cetera. But I know that WILL has probably had a plethora or just scores of shows and programs on this various issue. But if this globe simply has a growth mentality, if everyone simply adopts a growth mentality, we all know what that means. We all know what that means. It means the ultimate destruction of the universe. That's what it means. So we have to look for cleaner ways of growing. That's really what we have to do. We have to start controlling pollution. We've got to work together internationally. And these are just massive, massive issues. And I know, David, you probably had a score of programs, and there are certainly tremendous numbers of scientists and physicists and bioethicists that know a heck of a lot more about it than I do. But in its simplest form, if everyone is just, as you mentioned, caller, if everyone it just adopts a mantra of just growth, that's a problem. That's a huge problem because it just generates huge negative externalities. Look at China, for example, the most recent example, growing a GDP at 9 to 10% a year, right? Huge pollution issues, just amazing environmental problems. And people ask me, and they say, Dave, do you think this growth is going to continue? And I said, no, I don't think so. I think maybe in the short run, China is going to grow their GDP at 8, 9, 10% a year. But ultimately, they have to deal with these issues. They've got to deal with the fact that there's over a billion people who don't have health care in China. They've got to deal with that. That's going to slow down growth. They've got to deal with this tremendous amount of pollution that is pouring into their own rivers and streams and poisoning their environment. They're going to have to deal with those kinds of issues. So as a result, some of this growth is going to slow down because countries are going to have to deal with their own negative externalities. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. As long as we have this mantra of growth, that ultimately that's a real bad thing.
We have just about 10 minutes, a little bit more than 10 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580 with our guest, David Sino. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and College of Business. And once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about finance issues, personal finance issues, money management, investing. And so if people have specific questions, you'd like to get some advice, see what Dave thinks, just give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
David, I want to go back to this issue of subprime mortgages because I think it's extremely important. This whole mortgage area is important. Housing is so important because it has such a dynamic impact on our economy and GDP. I just want to explain to folks that who are seeking a mortgage, there are typically what are called conventional mortgages, and these are based upon what are known as Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac guidelines. In other words, the question arises, well, how much can I really afford to borrow? And there are some old percentage guidelines. Now, these are just guidelines, and they can be violated certainly a few percentage points either direction. But here's the bottom line. If we look at a property and we're going to procure a mortgage, that mortgage, along with the real estate taxes on that property and the monthly insurance on that property, we're going to add all three of those elements together. What's my monthly mortgage? What's my monthly real estate taxes? What's my monthly insurance bill? And that really should not exceed approximately 28% of my monthly paycheck, my monthly gross income. That's sort of a standard. And then we take another standard and we say, okay, we've got some monthly taxes, we've got monthly insurance on the property, we've got monthly mortgage payment. Now, what other monthly long-term debts do I have? Like a car payment, like a student loan, like a loan down at the bank. And we add all those monthly payments along with our original payments, and we add all that together, and that should not exceed approximately 36% of our gross income. That's about it. You start spending more than that just on shelter, and you're really going to be hitting and impinging on your cash flow. And that's what Fannie Mae tells us, and that's what Freddie Mac tells us. So if you have a 10% down payment, a 20% down payment, and you can procure a mortgage in those 28, 36% guidelines, then you're going to be conventionally financed, and you're going to be able to take advantage of very, very good interest rates in a 15-year or 30-year amortizing environment.
Well, you know, one, I don't know if our experience, Mrs. Inge and I, when we went down to, you know, apply for our mortgage, was typical.
Sure.
But we went in there, and of course, we gave them all the basic financial information they wanted, and then they did some number crunching, and they said, all right, we think that you would be able to take a mortgage payment of as much as this, you know, X amount of dollars. And I guess my feeling was that would have been imprudent for me to agree
no question.
To what was the top, you know. And so I'm thinking, well, is it typical for the bank to say, we think you can handle this kind of a monthly payment, where, in fact, if a reasonable person would look at that and say, no, that's too much. I don't think it would be prudent.
They've done the same math I've done for you here.
Yeah.
All they've done is they've looked at your 28% rules and 36% rules, and that's the stretch. That's sort of the apex. That's sort of the top. Mm-hmm. And you, as a prudent investor, said, wait a second, I don't need to be at those percentages. I'm more comfortable at 25 and 31 or 25 and 30 as opposed to 28 and 36%.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk with next someone in Terre Haute, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a significant amount of finances tied up currently in a small bank, a privately owned bank, and I was told that it'd be difficult for me to move it while the stock market was in good shape because people weren't interested in such investments. I was wondering, is the current recent volatility in the stock market going to make that a better thing to move, because I'd like to transfer it to a different kind of portfolio, or should I wait a little longer and hope for more volatility?
I really would doubt that volatility is going to be the major indicator of whether or not that you can move that small bank stock. Is that small bank stock traded on any kind of exchange?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay, so it's privately held, and what you really have is a liquidity issue. That's really the issue. Is there any trading going on in the stock at all?
It's trading, no, not too much right now.
Okay. Well, basically, whether the stock market is up or down or sideways, you probably don't have a great deal of correlation with the overall market. So I would suggest that that really has very, very little to do with it. It probably has more to do with how the small bank is actually doing, whether it's paying dividends, and whether there are current shareholders or other shareholders who are interested in accumulating your position. So if there isn't a public marketplace for this particular stock, what you might do is you might talk to the officers of the bank and mention that you have some interest, potentially, in selling some or all of your position, and how would I go about doing that?
Right.
Okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Right, very good. Next to Desplaines up in the Chicago area, line number 1. Hello.
Yes, hello. Hi, mm-hmm. David.
Mm-hmm. Morning.
Thought I'd ask a question. I've been a little shy about the market, and so I have quite a bit of cash reserves ready for me. So I needed some advice on how to, whether there's a percentage rule or a once-a-month rule to try to level out some stock investments, and if so, how would I coordinate that with your couch potato approach?
Well, if you are going to invest in the market, I can't recommend individual stocks. That's number one, because I don't follow individual stocks.
Yes, funds
so
is what I had.
I follow, right, indexes. Mm-hmm. And very frankly, I put money into the market the day that the market dropped 400 points on the Dow. So I'm a buyer.
Okay.
And that's me. But I'm a prudent buyer. I simply took about 10 to 15% of my ammunition and moved it into the market. So I'm just sort of waiting. But if I saw another 400 or 500 point drop, I would take another 10 or 15% and do it that way. Alternatively, you could say, look, the market is 5, 6, 7% lower than it was at the beginning of the year. That's not a lot. But over the next 12 to 18 months, I could take a certain amount of cash and say over the next 18 months, I dollar cost averaged into my positions. I wouldn't have any problem with that whatsoever. So if I had X number of dollars, I divide that by 1/12th or 1/18th, and once a month I enter the market and buy my positions.
And would you try to spread out each monthly amount into the diversified couch potato portfolio that you have, if your resources allow you to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have the resources to do that, remember that some of those indexes can be essentially substituted with what are called ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Mm-hmm. And exchange-traded funds take about $1,000 to buy those kinds of positions.
Oh, I see.
As opposed to $3,000 in an index fund at Vanguard.
I see.
All right? So you can actually buy the ETFs, which are identical for all practical purposes. There is a slight commission when you buy them, but over long periods of time, it sort of evens out.
I see. Well, that's a wonderful alternative.
Absolutely.
Then, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much for all the help.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks. Let's talk again with someone here on our line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had money for years in a mutual fund, and it was performing quite average. And back in 2005, I decided to close it out and move the money to another, split it between two funds. Within the same mutual fund family. And last week I got a letter from the IRS saying that I owed capital gains on that. Does that sound right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you, even though you moved in the same family, you actually liquidated shares.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, you received a 1099 B, which showed the total amount of the sale of the shares.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you need to go back then and figure out your tax basis in that position. Perhaps the mutual fund company itself can tell you what your tax basis was per share. Was it always at the same mutual fund company?
Yes.
Okay, then they should have that information. They can tell you, as of the date of sale, what was my tax basis per share. If they cannot, then simply you have to do some sleuthing, which consists of, one, figuring out how much money in hard dollars did I actually put into that position. And then number two, I have to go back to my tax returns and see all of the dividends that I reported on my tax returns that I paid tax on.
Mm-hmm.
And you add those numbers together, and that will give you your total basis in that mutual fund. So if you originally invested $10,000 and then over 5 years you reported another $2,000 of taxable dividends, then your basis would be 10 plus 2 or $12,000. Follow that?
Okay.
That's how you would do it. Then the difference between what you sold it for and what your basis, that would have probably been a long-term capital gain.
Mm-hmm.
And you would owe tax at the rate of 15% federally. And are you a resident of the state of Illinois?
Yes.
3% state of Illinois. So 18% of the gain, to the extent that you had some, would be subject to tax and must be reported on an amended return.
Okay. All right.
Good luck.
Thanks for the bad news.
Right, yeah, thanks for the bad news. Sorry about that.
All right, let's go one more. We have a caller here on the cell phone, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a quick question. I have a son-in-law who's beginning a new career after just graduating from college.
Congrats.
And, I'm sorry?
Congrats. Congratulations.
Yes. And he's beginning his first new job. And I'd like to know, the company offers a 401k program, but it does not contribute to it. Would he be better off not going with the 401k, but instead going with a, setting up a Roth IRA?
The answer is yes. That's a naked 401k where the corporation does not provide any matching funds. And that's sort of the exception to the rule. Most 401k plans have some type of match, so he needs to recheck that. Here's the answer. And the academic studies, in fact, I had a graduate student do this study. In the case of a naked 401k, the first place you put money is your own Roth IRA, $4,000. So if he's working, he needs to open a Roth, put $4,000 into that Roth. Then if he is still in a position to invest at that point in time, he could consider putting money and deferring money on a tax-deferred basis from his paycheck into the 401k.
Okay. Now, they do offer also an ESOP program where it's just company stock, and but that's...
Well, that's a program where you're buying stock at a discount.
Right.
And I first would buy the Roth IRA and get diversified. And then it might be okay, depending upon the company, to take a small percentage of your overall assets and invest them in the ESOP. But I would never, ever want to have a stock portfolio or my asset portfolio where I had more than somewhere of 10% of my total value of all of these securities in the company that I worked for.
Okay.
Otherwise, the Enron debacle can happen.
Right.
Okay?
Right. Yes. Thank you.
All
my
right.
Pleasure.
Thank you for the call. Well, we are just about the point where we have to finish up. Any last thing you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, no, we've had lots of great questions, and check your portfolios and don't panic. Remember, if you are well diversified, you're in good shape, and if the market goes down, think of it as a buying opportunity as opposed to a selling opportunity, because again, you're in the business of accumulating shares, and it's always fun to buy more shares when they're cheaper.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management and personal finance.